The following episode was recorded prior to the 2024 general election, in which Matt Hancock stepped down as a Member of Parliament.
What the UK did was unbelievably generous. What AstraZeneca did was, I think, the single biggest gift, corporate gift, in history, because it gave away all the billions it could have made in profit, like Pfizer did, like the others. The ones who created a successful vaccine made an absolute fortune, except for AstraZeneca. All they got was a load of unfair flack.
Hello, my name is Andrew Pollard. I'm director of the Oxford Vaccine Group at the University of Oxford. Welcome to our podcast series, The Oxford Colloquy, Trust in Science, bringing you the stories, facts, and people behind the science. In this episode, I'll be talking with Matt Hancock, the former Secretary of State for Health and Social Care in the UK government, about his experiences during the pandemic of 2020, and particularly in the issues around communicating health policy at that time. So, Matt Hancock, a Conservative politician and MP since 2010 for the UK government, thank you very much for joining us on this podcast.
It's great to be with you.
So we thought we would have some discussion today about the role of science in making health policy decisions and the processes that are happening in government. And you've had ministerial roles since 2015 in various different areas, and perhaps most importantly for this discussion, as Secretary of State for Health from 2018 to 2021. Can you tell us a little bit about your career and your experiences, both before being in politics and then during your role in Parliament, just to set the scene?
Yeah, so I'm a social scientist by background, and I worked both in my family tech company and then at the Bank of England. They were the two main things that I did before going into politics. So in terms of the interaction with science, I suppose I had enough of a scientific understanding to be able to have the conversation, but I'm not a scientist myself. You know, I have a master's in economics. So I had a decent statistical underpinning. And actually in the pandemic, that proved to be really helpful because, you know, the maths of economics and the maths of epidemiology are quite similar because, you know, the concept of the exponential is central to both of them. And in a way, when we got to the pandemic, that's the role I found myself in. I had brilliant scientific advisors around me and other scientists like yourself, Andrew, in the universities. My job was emphatically not to do the science, but I, you know, to be able to do my job communicating effectively, I had to understand it enough.
Coming then to thinking about the process within government and receiving scientific advice, which I guess is perhaps more visible to the public during the pandemic than normally. How does that work? Because I think the perception is that there is relatively little science amongst politicians and indeed in the civil service. And that's, I know that's changing to some extent. So a lot of the scientific advice is external. So how does actually that mechanism work for getting information into the system?
Yeah, well, in the first instance, at a first order level, the absolutely critical people are the chief scientific advisor and there are chief scientists in almost every department now. But I found that absolutely that much of the civil service are generalists. And in most cases, that's fine because their job is to, you know, take advice of all sorts, including scientific advice, and, you know, turn that into policy. But sometimes that doesn't work, right? And sometimes you do need a specialist in the room, and it isn't good enough, you know, just to have that translated science, if you like. There's another way of thinking about it also, which is, you know, the range of politicians is as broad as the range of society, right? And at one level, we talk about wanting politics to be a better reflection of the public. And so, you know, that system has to be built to be able to deal with everybody from, you know, somebody who might have a PhD in chemistry all the way through to somebody who gave up all sciences and hasn't done any science since the age of 16. And that's just a reflection of democracy.
But do you think, though, that when you come to the role, for example, that you've had as a Secretary of State for Health, would we be better served if the system had people with some knowledge in health, for example, who'd worked in the health system in that role? Or do you think that's completely unnecessary in the way the system works?
Oh, I think that as Secretary of State, that is not necessary because that's not your job. This is a really important point. The job is to represent the public within the system. That's what democracy is all about. So, you know, when I was going toe-to-toe with the BMA, for instance, when we settled the junior doctors dispute, I mean, it seems like ancient history now, but there was a dispute when I arrived, we settled it. Unfortunately, it's flared up again. You know, my job was not to be the doctor in the room. My job was to represent the public in getting the best out of the junior doctors, which meant settling the strike. It also meant, you know, for instance, improving a load of non-paid terms and conditions, which is how we came to an agreement in that space. The point is that your job is to deliver for the public and represent the public in a democratic system and take on board the scientific advice. Now, there are some people who are brilliant, who are, you know, full-blown research-level scientists who go into the political job. So I'm not against it. The point is that it isn't a necessary or indeed a sufficient part of the job description.
So I mean, you talked about that important role in sort of representing and not bringing your opinions, but of course politically, that world of debate is often about taking a position and debating and defending that position.
Yeah.
Whereas scientific debate is about presenting a hypothesis, and then the challenge of that is something which is trying to improve the quality of the evidence, and which is quite different from political debate, which can often be sort of ideological arguments about how you retain the position. So do you see a tension when you're, particularly in health, where you're, at least we hope, that we're trying to drive our policy underpinned by the best evidence, the tension between that and the political debate, which often then does happen about, you know, whether we want to have healthcare delivered in one way or another, or that, you know, which treatments should we have, can become politicized because there might even be public opinion which isn't evidence-based.
Yeah, the synthesis of those two is absolutely central to the job. So as a pro-science believer in objective reality, right? What I tried to do was protect the science as much as possible from those sorts of ideological whims. I'm not a very ideological person. I'm much more interested in practical results. So, for instance, take one thing that's very, very close to your heart, the recovery trial. In many countries around the world, the political pressure led to the calling of results before they were valid, right? The recovery trial was the right way to do it. There was pressure in the UK, for instance, from some of the newspapers, to call the results of recovery early. I saw my job as effectively trying as much as possible to put an umbrella, political umbrella over you, effectively, and Jonathan Van Tam and Chris Whitty and all the rest of the team, so that you could come up with objective results as well as possible. So you have to understand the political side enough to be able to put that protection into place, but you also have to understand the scientific side as to the validity of that. And of course, yeah, I wasn't the only one doing that. Chris Whitty put a huge amount of effort into stopping the more politicized elements of the system from calling a result when under pressure. And to give him his credit, Boris Johnson didn't push once it was explained to him that the point about clinical levels of validity. I think it's too easy to assume that all politicians are populists in this debate about the link between science and politics. High quality national leadership is not populist, as in trying to fit the evidence to your position, but rather it is political with a small p, in that, you know, there are these genuine political democratic pressures. They do have to be taken into account and managed to get an objective result. you know, another case was the second lockdown, right? There was huge political pressure against having a second lockdown. And there were those of us in the system saying, we know this grows exponentially. It is growing exponentially. There's only one result of an exponential growth, and that is very, very high case numbers. And it took us, frankly, 3 months to win that argument, sadly, of increasing evidence. In the end, we had to campaign, which is a political thing to do. I had to use my political campaigning tools in order to get the objectively right policy in place. And I took a huge amount of political flak for doing so, especially with the right of the Conservative Party, who didn't want to have a second lockdown, even though it was blazingly obvious to me that it was necessary.
I mean, I think the other thing, of course, is that I think, you know, if we're talking about that second lockdown, clearly scientifically it was the right thing to do. But there are other pressures that as politicians you were under. And I know from talking to Boris Johnson at that time that there were also pressures from backbenchers, from economists, yeah, from cancer doctors, also that needed to go into that. So how do you, when you're not just weighing up the science, put together all of these other pressures, which are also important, as you say, for a politician, yeah, to take into account?
Yeah, well, you have to take all those things into account. And in a way, the political process is the way that we do that in the UK. It is the sort of, you know, it is the best of all different options. You know, it is, and it is messy. And, you know, in practice, the way that those pressures, which are essentially democratic pressures, come through, you know, if I call them democratic pressures, then that sounds noble. If you call them political pressures, that sounds somehow nefarious. They're actually the same thing. There was a movement to say, you know, we tried that last time, let's not do it again. Personally, I thought that it was based on a misunderstanding of the concept of the exponential. People who said that there's a trade-off between the economy and health were wrong and proved to be wrong, because if you didn't get ahead of the health issue, there was an inevitability to a lockdown later. But it did also come down to elements of scientific advice. For instance, a central one, it was confidence in the vaccine. So, yes, I believed that a vaccine was very close to coming off because I'd been close to the project. I'd seen the results in. But within the system, that was not the prevailing view at all. And because it comes down to lay people's understanding of risk as well. Because when the senior scientists were asked, are we going to have a vaccine, right? A yes, no answer, they couldn't say yes to that. And essentially, there was a problem of too many people in the system not understanding that there are numbers between one and zero, right? And so this, again, comes back to my economist training, right? I have a whole training in risk and statistical analysis. That is, you know, years of my life. So for me, I was completely comfortable with that sort of analysis and trying to make judgments based on both risk and uncertainty, i.e. quantifiable and non-quantifiable uncertainty. And not everybody could get that. That definitely created challenges, should we say.
Now, for the general public, looking at the discussions that happen, which are debates, for example, today, still about whether the lockdowns should have been there or not, it seemed very much as a two-sided argument. There's just two sides, and there's equal weight to each of them. As we're discussing, whereas the scientific evidence was very different, it was very much weighted in one direction. How is the political landscape either helping or not helping that in the way that politics is just generally communicated across all topics, not just within health?
Well, I think this is actually a lot harder than it used to be. The communication of risk-based decisions in the public sphere has always been hard because you sell newspapers by having an absolute, and that's because they're responding to the human condition, which is that people want to know the answer. And therefore communicating risk is hard. Now you have a much worse problem, which is the extremes of the debate are then amplified through social media. So we still have, for instance, a significant and very unpleasant and aggressive anti-vax movement, which is probably bigger than it was before the pandemic. We see that in the take-up of non-COVID vaccines now, for instance. Absolutely vitriolic and absolutely sure of itself, and based on completely flawed statistics that can quite easily be taken apart by anyone with a modicum of stats. But the thing is, the nature of the algorithm is to see reinforcing voices. We all know that you get served the stuff you look for. And indeed, I've recently discovered that the algorithms put comments on posts according to comments that you previously have liked on some of the platforms. So it's not only that you get served the stuff that reinforces your views, it's that underneath it, two different people will have two different sets of comments, each which are closer to their own existing views. So the amplification of the extremes under social media has made this much, much harder and is a really serious problem for the political debate. And it's one of the reasons why there's been a hollowing out of the rationalists in the middle, if you like, in the political space.
I mean, just to come back to your point about routine vaccine uptake. So this is for children. And obviously, we're here in the middle of 2024 with measles outbreaks and with a rise in whooping cough in children because of under vaccination. But when we look at the reasons for that, a lot of it's actually around access to immunisation, making it easier for families to access both the clinic visit to get vaccinated, but also trusted information from GPs and practice nurses is much harder in the system than it has been in the past. And that, I think, actually the anti-vaccine bit you spoke about, which is important, but it's a much smaller part than those other issues when we look at that.
Well, I totally agree with you that you can tackle it with enough effort and resources and focus and attention. We did. But that wasn't an accident, right? That was getting all the newspapers on side, making sure we had we learned from the team who tackled Daesh in terms of setting out a counter narrative online. You don't directly tackle the anti-vaxxers. You're aiming to persuade those who are hesitant rather than those who are absolutely against, and overwhelming counter narrative with the NHS. So you're right, it can be done, and clearly effort needs to go into upping the rates of MMR and whooping cough and all the rest of them. I mean, there's a huge amount of effort that's needed, and you can do it. The reason I bring up vaccines is because they are one of the most difficult points of communication where, you know, the science is absolutely clear about them, rigorously monitored, and yet the political debate is very, it has these particular extremes that are so obviously against rationality, but that as a politician, you have to address. Even if, you know, I totally disagree with the anti-vaxxers, but in politics, in national communication, you don't bow to any of their substance, but you have to know they're there in order to be able to win the objective rational argument.
So what should we learn about health on health decisions from the pandemic? So from all those experiences that you went through, what have we learned something different about how we should approach health in the UK?
I think that there's a huge amount to learn. I think to those of us who were there in the system, in the health system beforehand, none of them are that much of a surprise. Absolutely central is the need for preventative measures and preventative healthcare, which is in vogue once again. It was the big debate in the late 2010s. I remember my first day as health secretary, Sally Davies came into my office and said, the absolutely central thing you need to do is make sure that we get prevention to the heart of the health system.
And so Sally Davis was the chief medical officer at the time.
Exactly. And the ICSs, which are now how we run the NHS in England, they are designed to be able to move money into preventative measures rather than just tick at the turnstile fixing problems. And of course, that's all discussed normally in the frame of non-communicable disease, but communicable diseases are all about prevention as well. And I think one of the lessons we've learned is you've got to be ready for a pandemic at any point. There has been quite a lot of thought put into that, but you know, if you think about the UK Health Security Agency budget, it's less than, it's tiny compared to less than 1% of the Ministry of Defence's budget, and yet the security risks to the country in terms of their impact and the number of lives lost is many orders of magnitude greater on the biosecurity side than on the physical security side. You know, if you step back and said rationally, this is our overall security budget, how much should we put into biosecurity, how much should we put into physical security, you know, you would put a decent chunk into biosecurity, and it's less than 1%. So, you know, one of the big lessons for me is preparedness and prevention, and doing the work now to be ready. You know, one of the reasons that it was challenging and difficult and we faced great uncertainty was not only that it was a novel pathogen, that wasn't the main reason. The main reason is nobody had lived this before. There wasn't a guide on the shelf. The guide that we did have, the pandemic preparedness plan, was conceptually flawed, and therefore the consequentials from it were in some cases very useful. We shouldn't, you know, I don't diss it all by any step, but we weren't ready, and the public, you know, hadn't experienced anything like this. And if anything, what they had experienced was a few false alarms over MERS and SARS and various bird flu worries.
But do you think we are better prepared now then from a government perspective?
Oh, undoubtedly better prepared than before. Christ. I mean, it'd be hard not to be. And the public's better prepared. You know, if you say there's another pandemic, you know, it's very bad. It's arrived. There's human to human transmission. You know what to do, right? And I think that's one of the reasons that the East Asian countries had a better response to COVID than we did, because they'd had a genuine experience as opposed to a false alarm. And then on the sort of purely mechanical side, you know, the PPE stocks are going to be pickable this time. There's a lot of work underway to get a vaccine within 100 days rather than a year. You've got to remember at the start of this, we were told it'll be 5 years minimum, and managed to reduce that to under a year, thanks to the huge amounts of work, especially at your university. And then obviously test and trace, which we essentially had to build from scratch. But all of those are second order practical things. The big difference next time there's a pandemic is going to be that we know how to think about when we need to lock down. So lockdown was not conceptualized in the plans that were on the shelf that I was briefed on. We had to work that out for ourselves. And the truth is, if you're going to have to lock down, and that is a very hard question, but if you're going to have to lock down, then you should lock down as soon as possible. And therefore, the decision becomes, at what point do I have enough information to know that I'm going to have to lock down, to know that the benefits of lockdown are going to outweigh the known costs of lockdown? As soon as you know that you are going to have to lock down, and in our case, it was the right thing to do because the reasonable worst case scenario was coming true, and the costs, whilst significant, were not as significant as non-lockdown. As soon as you can see that in the data, then you should lock down as soon as possible. But of course, that's a very hard decision because you're taking known costs for what is as yet an unseen alternative set of costs. And, you know, there's in philosophy, the acts and omission doctrine implies that you are more culpable for acts that you do undertake rather than acts that you omit to take. But the truth is that not taking a decision is itself a decision.
We talked a little bit before about finance, and if we look at the way health is delivered in the UK, we've got, I think in 2022, it was 11.3% of GDP went on the health spending. And that's very different from the US, which is over 17%. But it's actually similar to many other countries, some of which seem to do better than we do. So Sweden is a similar amount. Australia is a similar amount. What is it that we're doing wrong with our system, given our health spend is equivalent to some of the other Western democracies, and yet we have perhaps lower or poorer outcomes in some areas than those countries do?
I think it all comes back to prevention. It all comes back to the fact that the NHS is focused as a responsive system. And I'm a big supporter of the NHS model. But I think ultimately the way to improvement is through better prevention and support for society to be healthier in the first place. So, you know, the Prime Minister's action on smoking, I'm a massive supporter of. It is the single biggest determinant of gaps in healthy lifespan by region. So preventative action on the essentially the wider social factors that lead to poor health and poor health decisions, I think, is the single biggest determinant, in my view, of the gap between the countries that basically spend the same amount and essentially get good outcomes, like Japan, or essentially get poor ones, like the United States.
But there are lots of known interventions, like further reductions in smoking. But also, if we look at the quite rapid rise in diabetes and obesity, yep, particularly in children, which will, yep, feed through into major problems for the health system in the future, there are political solutions to those in, yes, terms of taxation and so on. Why yes, has it been so difficult to get those in place?
Libertarians. I mean, honestly, so damaging. For instance, one of the most successful taxes that has ever been introduced is the sugar tax, so-called soft drinks industry levy. Not only did it reduce sharply the amount of consumption of very sugary drinks, but it also led to industry reformulating to a lower sugar level and promoting the low sugar, like, you know, Coke Zero or, you know, other brands are available. And it's had a big positive impact. And yet there wasn't then a follow-up. Yeah, I pushed to have that expanded to a wider range of foods. It was blocked by the same, you know, group of people who didn't like lockdown, essentially. And to be honest, despite enormous support for this agenda from Public Health England, as was before the pandemic, because they were an arm's length body, they were seen as sort of chucking in rocks from the outside within the Whitehall system. So that's why I brought the health prevention or prevention of ill health agenda into the CMO's office, into the department, so that every policy that gets suggested within the government, you know, there's health secretary, you have an input into every single policy, but PHE didn't. So there are institutional changes within Whitehall that you can make to strengthen this argument. But ultimately, you've got to win the broader national debate, and you've got to win the, you know, the political debate to get these over the line. I think society is ready for more action here, to essentially to help people help themselves. You know, why do we ban smoking for under 18s? It's not because we want to ban things. It's because smoking's addictive, and, you know, liberalism liberalism is complicated by the concept of addiction.
So we spoke a number of times during the pandemic around various different issues. And one I just wanted to come back to is when you came and you visited Oxford and you went around the vaccine centre and I took you around the laboratory. We were talking then about vaccine equity. And as you may remember, I've always been quite passionate about in that period about making sure that we could ensure that vaccines that we had spare could be shared. And of course, now we're in the middle of the World Health Organization vaccine treaty, which is being discussed about how we might respond in the future. Yeah. And I think certainly in that period, the government wasn't very good at sharing our doses with other countries. That's something which came later than that sort of period in 2021. So what's your view now? Do you think, looking back with what we know now, that we got that right, particularly when you think the risk of mortality was very limited to older adults, of which there are many fewer in some of the low-income countries that we were discussing at that time?
I think we did the most extraordinary thing, and you were part of it. And I think we do an enormous disservice to ourselves when we don't articulate this. In ensuring that when AstraZeneca picked up the Oxford vaccine, and it was going to go to Merck, who were going to take it in a much more commercial direction, instead, AstraZeneca picked it up over a weekend. And they signed up to giving it away for free during the pandemic to the whole world, and they did that. And the result of that, which was Oxford's idea, strongly supported by the UK government, that AstraZeneca agreed to, so all three parties deserve credit in this, the result of that is that that vaccine was both the biggest vaccine in the world, saved the most lives, millions of lives, was by far and away the biggest used in the developing world. And in fact, during, you know, in 2021, there was a debate in the White House of should we require the vaccine companies to give away their vaccines with no IP? And it was incredibly frustrating because it was like, over here, you know, we've been doing this for more than a year now, and we've been delivering vaccines at cost worldwide from day one. So I think the only error in this space was not to win the argument that what the UK did was unbelievably generous. What AstraZeneca did was, I think, the single biggest gift, corporate gift in history, because it gave away all the billions it could have made in profit, like Pfizer did, like the others. The ones who created a successful vaccine made an absolute fortune, except for AstraZeneca. All they got was a load of unfair flack. So in this debate, I think, and I think you and I think Oxford should go into these debates saying, sure, we can have a debate about whether we give away, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of doses, but we gave away billions of doses by making the IP freely available. And if the WHO really cares about getting this right next time round, what we should do is have a memorandum of agreement between the major pharmaceutical companies that during a pandemic, they will ensure that developing countries can produce any vaccine that they develop, can manufacture that vaccine at cost. And the model would be the AstraZeneca contract that was signed between them and Oxford University. So I take no prisoners on this one, Andrew. I think we did an amazing thing. We really, really do ourselves down when we say we didn't do enough on this. And there are some politicians who make a load of noise about it, and I think they just miss the bigger picture, which is the millions of lives saved by Oxford University and AstraZeneca.
Matt Hancock, MP, thank you very much for joining us today on the podcast.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
That was the Oxford Colloquy Trust in Science, bringing you the stories, people and facts behind the science. So you might be wondering, what is a colloquy? A colloquy is a discourse or conversation, and I hope you'll agree that that's what we've been having.